August 13th, 2015. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Poke Runyon. And tonight we present a discussion on the Samaritans and their position in biblical and historical Palestine in relation to magic and Kabbalah. I'll be joined by our biblical scholar, Frater Solomon. We will mention a remarkable discovery we have made in reviewing the newly translated Samaritan Torah that tends to support our revision of the Tetragrammaton. And we will also discuss the Samaritan Book of Joshua and Wallace Budge's comments indicating that the Samaritans developed Gematria before the Judeans. Also, we'll discuss that famous or infamous Samaritan magician, Simon Magus. Did he really fly? And so, if you want to find out what the cursed Carthians have been up to, then tune in and we will climb Mount Gerizim. All right. The Samaritans, good and otherwise. In fact, if you Google Samaritans, you're going to come up with a bunch of charity groups and one thing or another before you get to the real Samaritans. Now, the real Samaritans are over in Palestine and centered around Mount Gerizim, and there's only about 725 of them left. They've been there, at least some of them have been there, for 2,500 years. And they claim to have an older version of the Pentateuch, the Torah, than the Orthodox Jewish people have. And then they might possibly be right. Although, I do want to say this about that the earliest Torahs we have, Samaritan and Masoretic, are no earlier than the Greek Septuagint. There was, back in Ptolemy's time, Ptolemy wanted a Torah for the Library of Alexandria. And there was a large Jewish community, of course, in Alexandria back in those days. And they only had one manuscript, the original in archaic Hebrew that they still had. And so he got a committee of rabbis in Alexandria together, and they translated that last remaining Torah that they had into Greek. Well, meanwhile, the last remaining Torah they had somehow disappeared or disintegrated or something or other, and all that was left was the Greek translation. So, the way the story goes, there are no Torahs any older than Ptolemy's commissioned Greek translation. And they had to, the Jews all over the world had to come and translate that Greek Torah back into Hebrew. And Frater Solomon, are you on there? Are you on with us?
I am here. We've got some exciting stuff to cover tonight. Actually, quite a bit.
Oh, good. Well, you heard what I just said about the Septuagint version being there's no Hebrew Torah older than the Septuagint translation, right?
That would make sense to me because you should figure that with all the archaeological research that has been done in Israel, the Torah probably didn't exist. I'm certain it didn't exist any earlier than Ezra, and it probably came to its final culmination at that time, which is why we don't actually have an older version of it.
According to what I've heard, though, they had one that all they could find in Alexandria when Ptolemy wanted a copy for the library to Alexandria. that huge Jewish community, all they could come up with was one old Torah, and they all got together and translated that into Greek, and then supposedly that disappeared, and then ever since then, if the Jews anywhere in the world wanted a Torah, they had to go to Alexandria in those days and copy the Greek one back into Hebrew. That's the way the story goes.
What century was that?
About 200 BC, I think, that occurred, somewhere in between 200 BC and the Common Era. But earlier than that, who knows? Now, of course, it could have been one down in Ethiopia, you know, because there were Jewish communities down there or whatever. I don't know whether this is true or not, but then most, however, I guess most of the Torahs that survived were taken out of, or taken back out of the Greek. However, the Samaritans, all of them were never taken into captivity. They stayed in the Holy Land ever since Moses brought them over. I mean, ever since they crossed the Jordan, they've been there. Most of them have been. So they claim that their Torah is the original, and that in the original Torah, it says that the holy mountain is supposed to be not Jerusalem, not Mount Moriah, but Mount Gerizim. And that's supposed to be the holy mountain. What?
Not only that, but something that's really interesting is the Dead Sea sect, the Dead Sea Essenes, their version of the Torah, actually, there's a mount of cursing called Mount Ebal and a mount of blessing called Mount Gerizim, and they're both mentioned in the book of Deuteronomy. However, something significant, there's the book of Deuteronomy talks about there being an important cultic center. And according to the Samaritan version of Deuteronomy, that's Gerizim, and those verses are taken out. One thing that's really interesting is there was supposed to be a holy mountain mentioned in Deuteronomy, and that was changed into Mount Ebal. But in the Dead Sea Torah and in the Samaritan Torah, it's actually Mount Gerizim. So the Masoretes actually edited out Mount Gerizim as being a sacred cultic center. And they made the holy mountain equal with the Mount of Cursing, which is Mount Ebal, rather than the holy mountain being the Mount of Blessing, which is Mount Gerizim. And Gerizim is mentioned in Deuteronomy, but the Masoretic scholars made sure it was mentioned less and tried to obscure its significance. And then later, the Jews tried to say, well, what Deuteronomy was doing was prophesying Jerusalem. Well, it wasn't. If you look at the original version of Deuteronomy, including what the Dead Sea scriptures have, the Dead Sea Torah have, Gerizim was the sacred site. Jerusalem was superimposed at a later time, and more than likely it was Ezra who tried to make that the new cultic center. He really tried to push that in making it a sacred spot.
So people don't get, we cut through some confusion here. Let's talk about this Kathian thing, because, the Kathians, that has caused a lot of confusion. Now, the way I understand it, and I want to get the dates right on this, when the Assyrians came in, and destroyed the first temple and carried off the tribe. They carried off the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin into captivity. But
I'll have to correct that. The Assyrians took some of the Samaritan nobles, like the king's family of the Samaritans at that time, which was called the Kingdom of Israel. They took the Samaritan nobles out of Israel, but they did not take the entire, there was no way they could round up all 10 tribes. They could only round up some members of Samaria, which was the capital of the Kingdom of Israel. And The interesting thing about DNA is it actually totally proves that the Samaritans are exactly who they say they are. They are blood relatives of the Sephardic Jews, the Jews who are native to the Middle East and don't have any admixture with them. They have a little bit of Kuthian blood in them, but it's insignificant compared to the overwhelming amount.
Let me stop you. Let me stop you here because this Kuthian thing, a lot of our listeners probably don't know this, but Kufa was a city in what's now Iraq. It was a city where the people worship Nergal, our Canaanite Mote, the Canaanite version of Mote is Nergal, the Lord of the Underworld, and the Assyrians moved a large number of Kuthians out of Kutha and put them right in the middle of Samaria.
And that is according to Ezra, though. And Ezra had a reason to mock the Samaritans because he was trying to legitimize his own people, his own tribe of Judah and Levi. He was trying to say, we're the real Israelites, and those guys aren't Israelites at all. And you should only listen to us and don't listen to them.
Mike. But however, the DNA, and you mentioned this, the Samaritans do have some Kuthian DNA. So there were some Kuthians moved in there.
They were mixed. What had happened while these Samaritans were slaves, they had married the Kuthians because they were both slaves together. So they brought back that Kuthian DNA. And Ezekiel, he existed a little bit before Ezra. He was part of the Babylonian exile. That's where the Jews were exiled to. And he says something that's really interesting. He says, the Samaritans, their mother is a Kuthian, but you Jews, your mother's an Amorite. Your mother's a Canaanite. So basically he's saying, Why are you so mad at the Samaritans for having mixed ancestry when you do yourself? I mean, Judah's wife was Tamar the Canaanite. So the denial that Ezra was trying to get these people to go through is just astounding.
Well, you know, more problem. Ezra has created more problems with his policies and his especially his his prejudicial racial policies and all of that. And as we discussed before and on the show, Ezra and Cyrus were in cahoots. And Cyrus, the king of Persia, he actually moved the Jews back into their captive their captivity. He moved them back into Jerusalem because he wanted to use them as in order to help control Palestine, which was then part of the Persian Empire. So he was using them as the same way the Tsar Nicholas, the old Tsar Nicholas, used the Cossacks in Siberia. You know, Tsar Nicholas took the Cossacks over out into Siberia and said, kick these Mongols out, take the land, you can have your farms but you're still in the Army Reserve. So it's conquer by using people like that as mercenaries. So actually, Ezra and his Jews were Persian mercenaries, and then they proceeded to try to Judaize all of Palestine. You know, they went on an evangelical campaign which lasted all the way up to Jesus' time. Ezra is, you know, not one of my favorite people, I think that he's caused a lot of problems that we still have, including forcing all the Jews to give up their Canaanite wives and children
disgusting.
He was
Ezra was politically incorrect to the max. You know? He was really, really a piece of work. But anyway, so let's, before we get any further, we said we were going to mention the remarkable discovery that we made in reviewing a newly translated Samaritan Torah. By the way, you loaned it to me, and I got it sitting here. It just got published. The Israelite Samaritan Version of the Torah, and it's translated by Benjamin Tazdaka, and he's a Samaritan rabbi. And this is beautiful because he's got the comparison. He has the Torah, the Samaritan Torah on one side, and the Masoretic text on the facing page. So you can compare the two directly, line for line. And the thing, of course, that really floored both of us when we looked at this, especially getting into Genesis, all the way from Genesis through Exodus and all that, God, or God, as the fundamental Christians like to say, is the Jews say Adonai, and the Samaritans say Shema. And as you recall, we changed our 22-letter tetragrammaton to Shemat. And which is very, very close to Shema. It's just Shema with a Saturnian tau on the end of it. Yeah. And it's kind of finalizing the whole thing. And the 22-letter version, 24-letter version of that is a Masha'o, but that's you know, but essentially we started with Shema. And we thought years and years ago, and the reason why we did that was because I think it's about 30 years ago at Monsobat, we had a whole bunch of Sephardic Jews visit us for a seasonal. And everything was going fine. We were having a grand time with these people. And then we went out to the Henge to do the seasonal and to open up. And the deacon came out to do a pentagram ritual. And as soon as he vibrated Yod Hey Wow Hey in the pentagram ritual, all of our Sephardic guests of our Hasidim, they all formed ranks and marched out in column, right? Out of the yard and out to their cars and drove away, and that was the last we ever heard from them. And I got to thinking, you know, after that, and I did a lot of thinking after that, and I thought, wait a minute here now. The Golden Dawn uses YHVH, you know, and all that, and why can't we do that? And the Christian Bible uses Yahweh and Jehovah, and why? So what's the problem here? And I realized that from an Orthodox Jewish perspective, that's their God, and if their God is nobody else's, and they really resent us using that name, and they don't do YHVH. They always do Adon, which I suppose if we just said Adonai instead of going Yod Heh Wah Heh, we probably would have been okay with them. That might have been, I don't know. But this experience got me to thinking about finding a better, a more proprietary, a tetragrammaton we could call our own. And so with that, I took the three mother letters, which are more creative according to the Sefer Yetzirah. They are the creative letters, you know, in the cube of space, whatever. And we made our tetragrammaton Shema Atah. And that means left mem sheen and tau completing it in the center of the cube. And
that's a very old, that tetragrammaton goes back to at least 1350 BC, which is due to some discovered text that the Egyptians had. They had six groups of tribes they called the Shasu, which were probably descendants of the Hyksos. They have the Shasu of Shema Atah, same spelling. They have the Shema. They have the Shasu of Yahu, which is the Jewish Shasu. Then they have the Shasu of Seir, that that's an Edomite god than the Shasu of Laban, which is a Lebanese root name for Lebanon. And then you talked about your version of the name El as Ul. Well, they had a version of a Shasu of Ul Baal and another Shasu of Piasepas. So Shema Atah, as a name for God, or at least one of these early tribes, their God, more than likely, they were either called Shemot or their God was called Shemot. So it's a very, very old tetragrammaton, which confirms your inspiration in that direction.
Well, that of course, warms the heart of my cockles, however, we notice all through wherever the Masoretic text says Adon, Adonai, you go over on the Samaritan side and it's Shema. Now a couple more things about this. The Hebrew word for son is Shamash, and the Canaanite sun goddess was Shapshish, and Shin, of course, is the letter for fire, and so what we have here is not just a very, very ancient tetragrammaton, but what we also have here is the beginning of solarization, and this might very well be of an Egyptian origin. And because the Egyptians were solarized before the Semites were. The Semites didn't like the sun because they were desert people essentially, and the sun was the enemy. They were Saturnian and lunar oriented more than they were solar oriented. And yet the Egyptians were solar-oriented from way back early. And then the Greeks, of course, eventually became solar-oriented. And so they returned when Alexander took over the Palestine and whatever. Of course, the Samaritans hated Alexander, but still, they fully solarized at that point. And we also, Hercules was a solar entity, and he was Melkart. And he was the god of Tyre, so he was certainly solar. And so this may also be the beginning of the beginning of Tiphereth as the center of the Tree of Life, and the beginning we may be seeing the beginning of solarization and Shema. And yet I have to say this because sure enough, somebody listening to this show who knows as much about this as we do is going to say, "Yeah, you guys, but what about what they actually write how do they actually write God in that Samaritan Torah?"
They write it YHBH, why do they do that? If they call it Shema, why do they write it Yahweh? Well, that's a good question, and it deserves a good answer. And the answer probably is, I would think, is that Ezra made them do it. Ezra had so much influence on them, and also, Wallace Budge tends to confirm this in his very interesting chapter in Amulets and Talismans. Wallace Budge's Amulets and Talismans on Samaritan amulets. And all of their tetragrammatons and their amulets, all YHVH. And so they really did use it gematria-wise and all. They used it, but they called it Shema. Shema to them was cognate with the Hebrew Adon. And so we have to own up to that, because even though Shema is the way they said it, that's not the way they wrote it. And I think that's the influence of, I think personally it's the influence of Ezra. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree. I think they did it in reaction. Ezra was the one who started the tradition of saying, let's call God Adonai. The Jehovah of the preceding century is the oldest text we have. It goes to 840 BC, where he was where the God of Israel was called Jehovah YHVH, older Yahoo. But Ezra was trying to create his own version of God. So all the Jews, whenever they refer to God, they call him Adonai. Whenever, that was probably due to some Aton influence. From a Kenaton. There's actually a psalm that quotes a whole hymn of praise to a Kenaton, but they just changed the name from Aton to Jehovah. It's the same it's the same praise hymn though. So the influence of Atonism on Ezra's Judaism is pretty clear. So they had to do something to say, well, what's our name for God going to be? And they were already calling God Shema. They wouldn't just put some arbitrary name. They would put a name that they were already using to call God, and their name was Shema. And yeah. They wanted to say, you know, you're calling him Adonai, but that's not really God's name. That's Ezra's God. So we're going to call him what we've always been calling him, and one of the names that we've been using is Shema, and that's the name we're going to keep using.
Yep.
And that matches, 1300 BC, Shemot, as an ancient name going that far back in that region, that shows that the name Shema is a very, very ancient origin, Shema or Shema Atah.
Yeah. Let's get a little bit technical here and mention something. We have had, this also applies to that recent review we did on Stephen Skinner's book, The Solomonic Magic, where he was, Skinner was trying to say that Solomon's hydrology was actually dating from classical times, and yet at the same time, as I pointed out, he says that. However, the earliest manuscripts we have don't date any earlier than 1500, and for Solomon's hydrology, so. The same thing applies here to the Torah, to the Samaritan Torah. We don't have any copy of the Samaritan Torah that is any older than about 1200 and something. So that's 1200 AD, AD not BC, and yet. People are saying that, well, yeah, this is 2500 BC. I don't think so for this reason. The idea of taking manuscripts like in the case in like Solomon's hydrology, which eventually became the Key of Solomon, and this also applies to the Samaritan Torah, is this. If you have, back in the old days, they didn't have Xerox machines, copy machines, or anything like that. They didn't even have photostats. So consequently, if you wanted to preserve a manuscript, an old manuscript, the thing's falling apart, you know, and you look at it and you say, oh my gosh, do something, this thing is going to completely disintegrate. So what do? You take it to a scriptorium, a monastery scriptorium or public scriptorium or whatever. You take it to a scriptorium and you give them whatever they need to make a copy of it. You know, how many sheep or goats or whatever, or shekels or whatever you need to pay them to get you a good copy. So they have on vellum or on papyrus or on parchment or whatever it is that they're going to copy it for you. And so the old monk gets up there with his inkwell and his quill pen and his and your old manuscript or scroll and his new parchment or papyrus or whatever, and he goes to work. Well, and you tell him, now I want an exact copy, because this, you know, we're preserving this, and don't change not one jot or tittle, as you know who used to say. And
So here are the problem is that scribes, they'll copy it, but they're going to copy it in the language that they understand. And, you know, you want to copy the Hebrew. Okay, he's a Hebrew scribe. He knows Hebrew, but the Hebrew he knows is more recent than the Hebrew of that manuscript, and the punctuation and all is going to be his, what he knows. And that's how he's going to do it. So consequently, so he gives you your copy, and you've got it, and you walk out with it, and then 2,000 years later, some guy, you know, who has a computer looks at this thing, and he says,
uh-oh, this isn't any earlier than when you had it copied, because he is judging
by the way it was copied, by the punctuation and the letter forms and everything of the scribe who copied it. And this, unfortunately, has been a problem with all of these recopied old manuscripts. You cannot tell from them how old the original is. It's just strictly guesswork. And you can kind of get a general idea by content analysis. Maybe you can say, oh, well, looks like it was much, much older, but you really can't tell. You can't. So this is a constant problem with this. And this is why, I took Stephen Skinner to task on his techniques of Stalemolic magic, trying to claim that the Solomon's hydrology was classical rather than medieval. What do you think about that, Mike?
Yeah, we're not going to... All the originals of the Bible that we would like to have, we just don't have them anymore. They probably decayed somewhere. So we've had the scribes putting them together. There's actually good evidence that the Torah, as we know it, the five books of Moses, the writing styles, you have at least three different writing styles in there. Deuteronomy has its own writing style, its own author. And then the other four books of Moses, you have two authors. You have the Yahwist, who always use the name Yahweh for God, and then you have the Elohist, who always use the name Elohim for God. And you have actually different stories. They're told in a little different way, and you can see them fused together as though some author whose writing style is similar to Ezra, he's trying to piece them together. And a couple of phrases that Ezra typically used throughout the Pentateuch, he is... John Friedman, he calls him the redactor, and he says the redactor, the guy who weaved this all together, who has his own writing style where there's snippets of trying to join things together, he writes exactly as Ezra did. So that would be our culprit for the guy who put the Torah together pretty much in its current form.
Yeah. So when it comes to how to recopied manuscripts, it's guesswork, and of course it doesn't carbon dating and doesn't do you much good. Now this does not apply, however, to clay tablets. Our clay tablets from Mesopotamia. And whatever hieroglyphics are painted or carved and down in Egypt or incised on stone or whatever, you could pretty well date those but then they got a lot of times, as Herschel Shanks has found out, you know, to his chagrin sometimes. What you buy from a collector that in an ossuary box or whatever, does a lot of times it's fake, and there's a tremendous business in fake artifacts in the Middle East. You know, a lot of those. And now let's mention the most famous or infamous Samaritan of all.
Simon Magus.
One of our good friends, Simon Magus. Yeah, Simon Magus. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with Simon Magus, he was a contemporary of Jesus, probably a student of a student of John the Baptist, just like Jesus was,
And also, interestingly enough, with Simon, that there's a lot of parallels. In fact, somebody even wrote a book claiming that Simon was actually Jesus, and there's so many similarities between the two that I can see what his point might be. Simon needed a priestess, and so he went to a
according to what says, he went to a brothel in Tyre and got a lady of the night out of the brothel and called her Helena, after Helen of Troy, and claimed that she was the fallen thought of God, in other words, the son of Sophia. And then he proceeded to
use her in his ceremonies and whatever. Simon was a magician who was not averse to prestidigitation, and if it served his purpose one thing or another, and he kind of inspired Marcus later on to I'm sure to do some things. Now Jesus at the same time, Jesus takes up with Mary Magdalene, who some people still think was a lady of ill repute. I don't think she was, but that's Magdalene. The term Magdalene actually got it ended up being used for a euphemism for harlot or whatever. But the similarity, with Jesus. Jesus taken up with Mary Magdalene and Simon with Helena is pretty significant. Now Simon, Simon at a certain point, Simon got very disillusioned and he hadn't performed any miracles in a while and one thing or another. And he decided, and I believe this was in Rome that he did this, he decided he was going to demonstrate that he could fly. Mm-hmm. And of course, the way the story goes, he got himself on top of a tower, and he sat on top of this tower, and actually it wasn't a tower, it was a great big, like a big pole, you know. And he was up on top of the pole, and he said he was going to fly down from the pole, he said. And Peter got a mob together and what they did was they shook the pole, and I'll explain it in a minute. But anyway, but the gist of it is that Simon flew, but he hit the ground hard enough when he
it wasn't a landing he could walk away from, let's put it that way.
And now, what's behind all this, the real story on this is this. Simon was doing something that in that time was kind of popular for prophets to do, or mystics to do. They called themselves stylites. And what they would do is they would erect a great big tall pole, like a big tall telephone pole or something like that, like the mast of a ship. And on top of that, they would build it on the top of that pole, they would have a crow's nest, you know. And then they'd have a bunch of handholds or spikes, you know, so you could climb the pole like a telephone pole, you know, up to the top. And what they would do is they would sit up on this little crow's nest up at the top of the pole, and they'd look at the sun, and of course that, you know, you do that long enough and you're going to go blind, but they'd sit up there in this hot sun, virtually naked, maybe just a loincloth, and then they'd wait up there until they either received enlightenment or they flew or something or other. They'd stay there. And some of them used to stay on these, up on top of these poles for days and days and days. And this was Simon wasn't the only one to do this. I mean, there's a number of people did this, and that's what. But here's what: if you are down, you know, if you're down there below or surrounding the pole of a stylite, and you're staring up at him, and it's a bright sunlit day, and you're staring up at the optical phenomenon, and we know this from zero light experiments. The optical phenomenon, it'll appear like this guy is actually flying up off the pole. Yeah, you stare at him long enough, and it looks like that. And the stylites, I guess, at some point they realize that would happen. And so, if you think he's flying, then of course, naturally, eventually, when he comes down off the pole, he'll say, "Yeah, okay, I flew. You saw me fly." And but it's an optical phenomenon. So Simon's sitting up there, and his with a crowd looking up at him. And probably they were starting to think that he actually was lifting off the top of the crow's nest. And that's when Peter and his mob, no, he's not really flying. No, we'll show you. And they knocked the pole down, or they shook the pole until Simon fell off. And that's what really happened. And so Peter, kind of responsible for murdering Simon. That's kind of a shame, but because anyway.
I have some thoughts on that. That's a later legend that I think was done more to discredit Simon. It doesn't quite match where it was left off with in the Book of Acts. Simon, my guess is that he was a follower of John the Baptist, and when John the Baptist died, his own sect left behind. They still exist today. There's only a couple hundred of them left, called the Mandians, and they thought Jesus was a faker, and John the Baptist, was preaching a different religion, and that was probably, Simon was affiliated with them, but then Philip starts preaching, and he says, I think this is right. And, the Gospel of Philip really follows the Gnostic tradition attributed to Simon Magus. And this is one of the stories that's made up. Sometimes these kind of stories are made up after the fact in order to discredit someone. But when Simon hears the apostles preaching, he says, I agree with this message. And they said, Peter says, you're trying to buy these gifts from us. And Simon says, okay, I'm sorry about that. And I'll just pray that the Lord forgives me and that I can get everything right. So there's a possibility that legend, he might have given this image of flying. And we know he was a little bit deceptive, and it's the type of thing he would do. But the legend of Peter killing Simon, it doesn't appear in the Book of Acts. Josephus doesn't mention it. I don't think even Justin Martyr or Irenaeus mention it, but these type of legends popped up in the Middle Ages sort of as a way to discredit Simon, because he's the one who continued the Gnostic tradition when the Christians were trying to get rid of the whole awesomeness of Gnosticism. I'm not saying that Simon was the founder of Gnosticism. I think Jesus was the founder of Gnosticism, but I do think that he converted to it, and he had his own version of Gnosticism that persisted through a group called the Simonians, and they don't have that record of his death.
Well, Simon did at one time, according to Acts, he did at one time try to join the Christian community and was refused. In fact, he supposedly wanted to buy his way in. And they refused him. Yeah. I can understand that, because he was actually a competitor. He was a competitor of Jesus, and so they certainly, I can understand why they would. However, what I said about the stylites was correct. There's people that they did do this. They did do this
on
top of the pole.
That has to be based in reality. That has to be something that he did, because he was someone who's trying to promote himself as someone with all these powers.
Yeah.
And we know he's a little bit shady about it, too, based on Acts.
And, we know that he wasn't the only one that did this. There was a whole bunch of them. That wasn't the only thing they did. There were other crazy things they did. The Gnostics, some of the extreme Gnostics were just like Indian fakirs. They did all kinds of very strange stuff, especially down in the desert or in Egypt. I mean, they went out and they did, you know. That's where a lot of these stylites, these stylites, they'd have a whole bunch of pictures I think Hieronymus Bosch, in some of his surrealistic paintings, he has these stylite towers sticking up with the crow's nest on the top of them, if you look closely. Albrecht Gruer did an engraving of Peter knocking Simon off the pole. That's one of the Albrecht Gruer things. So Simon is probably the most famous or infamous of the Samaritans. I'm very fond of Simon Magus. I think some of his ideas were really excellent. He had some analogies. By the way, he had analogies of the rivers, the biblical rivers, the four rivers of Edom, that were supposed to be, according to Simon, they were supposed to be inside a woman's womb. Those rivers, and he had a whole anatomy, a sort of a theological anatomy that he came up with that is really fascinating. We're getting down to the wire here. Is there anything else that you would like to mention about the Samaritans or Simon or something before we wrap it up?
Yeah, we didn't get to touch on Mary, and I studied her father was her father's name was Joachim, and he was a priest according to the Gospel of the Birth of Mary. Now there was a Samaritan high priest in Mary's day, and his name was Joachim. And the interesting thing is the story about this Joachim. He goes to a priest whose name is, and I'm assuming this was the priest who came right before the Samaritan high priest, Joachim. His name is not Simon, son of Boethus, who was the Jewish high priest. He goes to another high priest who was high priest before he was, named Issachar. Now, whether this name was made up or not, Issachar was who the Jews said the Samaritans were descended from. I'm not sure, but I think we could pretty confidently say that Mary was actually the son of a Samaritan high priest and her husband. One thing, we talked about Joseph being a family name of the Herodians in some of our conversations. I found out Herod the Great did have a brother named Joseph. Of course, we know he was the father of Antipater, but Antipater died 4 BC, which means if Antipater was really the father of Jesus, Mary would have had to marry someone else within the clan. And I'm guessing that she married maybe Joseph, the son of Joseph, or Herod just had another son or a close relative named Joseph, because we know that they passed family names on. To the next generation. Joachim's father-in-law was named Mathan, which is an Aramaic variation of who the preceding high priest was, according to the Samaritans, who was Nathanael. So my theory is, Joseph was a Davidite, but he was a Davidite that had married into the Edomite clan, and we know the Davidites were not respected in Jesus's time, because the Maccabees, who were Levites, were trying to oust him, and they were trying to pretty much rule the Jews at that time. So they didn't want the Davidites to have any authority. But according to the Herodian scribe Nicholas, Potters, they had married into Edomites for generations, but they actually descended on their father's 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 line from David himself. So, I think we're on to something really exciting, where the Samaritans could be an incredibly important component both Samaritans and Edomites could be an incredibly important component to Jesus' ancestry.
Yeah, and definitely a connection into the whole Jesus genealogy, and that seems to be indicated too in Jesus and the Good Samaritan parable. He's trying to they're trying to rehabilitate the Samaritans with that, and because you know to kind of justify. To justify the family connection, and which of course is, it kind of goes along with the people that want to think that Jesus and Simon Magus might have been the same, person, but I don't buy that. I think Simon Magus was definitely a separate, and one of the reasons for that is I read as much as we know about Simon's philosophy. And it's just not the same as what we know about Jesus.
His own spin.
Yeah, but it's his own. It's definitely Simon's own spin. And so anyway, that's about all the time we have. And next week we will dig deeper and deeper into this. A business of Jesus's genealogy and whatever, which is something we're working on right now for the second volume of the yoga book, and so until then, don't anybody try kind of sitting on top of a pole,
don't, especially if you're going to do that, don't look at the sun. Don't stare at the sun.
Okay. And thanks a lot, Frater Solomon. And thank you for the loan of the books of the Samaritan Torah and whatever. And we'll see everybody next week, and we'll do it again. Until then, good magic.
Good magic.